months ahead of the financial crisis, 2.5 years before Obama took office, the launch of the Hamilton Project presents the world view of some of his most influential advisers in microcosm. It reveals both what they could see and what they could not. Having returned to the business world in 1999, Rubin was worried about the drift in Washington. Globalization had been the central challenge of the 1990s. In the new millennium, it was even more so. But 2 years into President Bush's second term, the policies of the Republican administration were putting America at risk. Rather than mitigating the pressures of global competition, they were dividing American society. This risked provoking both an anti-globalization backlash and a catastrophic financial crisis that would call into question America's monetary stability and the global standing of the dollar. Not that Rubin and his circle were doing badly out of a world of globalization. After the Treasury, Rubin had retired to an influential sinecure as a non-executive chairman of the board at Citigroup. Orszag, who started his career bouncing back and forth among academia, government, and consulting, would in due course end up at Citigroup too. But for average Americans, the story was different. There had been good moments. The Clintonites still celebrated the 1990s and the twin booms of tech and Wall Street. But since the 1970s, wages had not kept up with productivity. For the meritocrats of the Hamilton Project, it was clear where the finger of blame pointed. America's schools were failing to give its young people the education essential to stay ahead of the game. The first reports issued by the Hamilton Project bristled with proposals to improve the recruitment of teachers and make better use of kids' summer vacations. It was a kind of nuts and bolts, evidence-based, non-ideological approach to productivity improvement that dominated economic policy discussion of the era. Its purpose, however, was eminently political. As Obama put it in his keynote, "When you invest in education and healthcare and benefits for working Americans, it pays dividends throughout every level of our economy. I think that if you polled many of the people in this room, most of us are strong free traders and most of us believe in markets. Bob Rubin and I have had a running debate now for about a year about how do we in fact deal with the losers in a globalized economy. There has been a tendency in the past for us to say, well, look, we've got to grow the pie, and we will retrain those who need retraining. But, in fact, we have never taken that side of the equation as seriously as we need to take it. Just remember, there are people in places like Decatur, Illinois, or Galesburg, Illinois, who have seen their jobs eliminated. They have lost their health care. They have lost their retirement security. They believe that this may be the first generation in which their children do worse than they do." This was a betrayal of the American dream of endless uplift, and that risked spilling over into a political backlash. As Obama put it, "Some of that then will end up manifesting itself in the sort of nativist sentiment, protectionism, and anti-immigration sentiment that we are debating here in Washington. So there are real consequences to the work that is being done here. This is not a bloodless process." Amid the fears about globalization and the risk of populist revolt already evident in 2006, there was one note of economic nationalism that Obama himself was not afraid to strike. "When you keep the deficit low and our debt out of the hands of foreign nations, then we can all win." Alongside global competitiveness, the other preoccupation that defined the Hamilton team was the question of debt. As Clinton's Treasury Secretary, Robert Rubin's great boast was to have turned the deficits of the Reagan era into substantial budget surpluses. Since then, under the Republicans, America was headed fast in the wrong direction. In June 2001, in the wake of the dot-com bust and a disputed election, the Bush administration had delivered a tax cut estimated to cost the federal government $1.35 trillion over 10 years. This paid off key constituencies, but it also wiped out Rubin's surpluses, and it did so deliberately. The Republicans had convinced themselves that surpluses tended to encourage more government spending. Their approach was the obverse, what Republican strategists of the Reagan era first dubbed starving the beast. By entrenching tax cuts and courting a fiscal crisis, they would create an irresistible imperative to slash spending, curb entitlements to social welfare, and shrink the footprint of government. The problem was that the spending cuts that were supposed to follow the tax cuts never happened. The terrorist attack of September 11, 2001, put America on a war footing. The Bush administration responded with a huge surge in defense and security spending. In a manner horribly reminiscent of Vietnam, it then plunged America into the Iraq quagmire. In 2006, as the Hamilton Group met, Iraq was on the edge of a bloody sectarian civil war. The question now was how to get out. Iraq was not only demoralizing and humiliating, it was also hugely expensive. The Bush administration did its best to keep the costs of the war off the regular budget, so a cottage industry of Democratic Party experts set itself to doing the sums. By 2008, the bill for Afghanistan and Iraq alone was at least $904 billion. Less conservative estimates put the bill as high as $3 trillion. It was certainly more than the United States had spent on any war since World War II. Of course, it could have been paid for. America was far richer than it was at the time of Pearl Harbor. But the Bush administration was not only not going to reverse its tax cuts. In May 2003, it doubled down, introducing a further round of tax relief. Given that the military budget was sacrosanct and the rest of discretionary expenditure was not large enough to make a difference, the Republicans proposed to close the gap with grossly inequitable cuts to welfare entitlements. Those, however, could not pass the Senate, where the Republican majority was wafer-thin and moderates held the balance. It was this logjam that turned Rubin's budget surplus of $86.4 billion in 2000 into a record deficit of $568 billion in 2004, with no end in sight. The original inspiration for the Hamilton Project was a paper written in 2004 by Orszag and Rubin sounding the alarm. First, the Bush deficits would drive up interest rates and squeeze private investment. Further down the line lurked a far more serious scenario. Substantial deficits projected far into the future can cause a fundamental shift in market expectations and a related loss of confidence both at home and abroad, Rubin and Orszag dryly remarked. The unfavorable dynamic effects that could ensue are largely, if not entirely, excluded from the conventional analysis of budget deficits. This omission is understandable and appropriate in the context of deficits that are small and temporary. It is increasingly untenable, however, in an environment with deficits that are large and permanent. Substantial ongoing deficits may severely and adversely affect expectations and confidence, which in turn can generate a self-reinforcing negative cycle among the underlying fiscal deficit, financial markets, and the real economy. Conventional analysis, in short, was not sufficiently alarmist. What it did not seriously entertain was the possibility that America was headed toward fiscal or financial disarray. Veterans of the Clinton administration knew what they were talking about when they invoked a negative cycle of underlying fiscal deficit, financial markets, and the real economy. This, in their view, is what they had inherited from the high-spending Reagan and Bush administrations. In 1993, faced with a bond market sell, Clinton had shelved ambitious plans for a stimulus. Egged on by Rubin and Fed chair Alan Greenspan, deficit reduction became a mantra of the Clinton team. Chief political adviser James Carville was left to ruminate, "I used to think if there was reincarnation, I wanted to come back as the president, or the pope, or a 400 baseball hitter. But now I want to come back as the bond market. You can intimidate everybody." In the 1980s and 1990s, the so-called bond vigilantes had their day in the sun. 10 years later, they were still in the market. Indeed, the bond funds were bigger than ever. But, as Obama had hinted, domestic investors were not what most worried the Rubinite crowd. Foreign investors were the key concern. The Bush administration's deficits were financed overwhelmingly by bond buying from abroad. As Orszag and Rubin's paper remarked, United States treasuries were still seen as the safest investment in the world. There was no chance of default or a sudden burst of inflation. But if that expectation were to change, and investors had difficulty seeing how the policy process could avoid extreme steps, the consequences could be much more severe than traditional estimates suggest. nor was it just the Clinton crowd that worried. In 2003, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office saw fit to remind its audience of an extreme scenario in which foreign investors stopped buying U.S. securities, the dollar plunged, and interest rates and inflation shot up. Amid the anticipation of declining profits and rising inflation and interest rates, stock markets could collapse, and consumers might suddenly reduce their consumption. Moreover, economic problems in the United States could spill over to the rest of the world and seriously weaken the economies of U.S. trading partners. The scale of America's deficits made it vulnerable to bond market pressure. The fact that foreign investors might suddenly turn away from treasuries evoked the nightmare of a sudden stop to external financing of America's imbalances. But it was the identity of the foreign investors that infused the scenario with real terror. Until the 1980s, the major foreign investors in the United States had been European. Then Japan, with its giant trade surpluses, had taken over. Still, in the new century, it was one of America's largest creditors. But in the 1990s, with a surging yen and a domestic economy crippled by a devastating real estate bust, Japan's competitive threat had faded. Since the millennium, globalization had acquired a new Asian face. In April 2006, when Obama spoke about keeping our debt out of the hands of foreign nations, everyone knew it was China and its communist regime that he was talking about. Since the 1970s, China had been a cornerstone of U.S. geopolitics. Nixon and Kissinger had unhinged the fronts of the Cold War by breaking China out of the Soviet embrace. Now the Soviet Union had faded from view, and the European theater of the Cold War had faded along with it. The Pacific was the new horizon of American power, and China the future rival. For the first time since the rise of Nazi Germany, the United States faced a power that was, at one and the same time, a potential geopolitical competitor, a hostile political regime type, and a capitalist economic success story. The fact that Obama came to the Brookings meeting from talks about a nuclear deal with India was a telling coincidence. America was looking for new allies in Asia. But what mattered more than nukes, at least as far as the Hamilton crowd was concerned, was economics. The Clinton administration had midwifed China into globalization. In November 1995, Washington encouraged Beijing's application to join the newly founded World Trade Organization, WTO. America had done this before, of course, with Western Europe after 1945, with Japan and East Asia in the 1950s and 1960s, and with Eastern Europe in the 1990s. Opening markets was good for American business, for American investors, and for American consumers. America's economic interests were so widespread that they were de facto identical with global capitalism. By the mid-1990s, Washington had abandoned any frontal challenge to the Chinese communist regime over human rights, the rule of law, or democracy. Instead, globalists of both the Democratic and Republican parties wagered that the powerful and impersonal force of commercial integration would in due time make China into a biddable and congenial stakeholder in the world order. China's growth was spectacular. Huge profits were to be made for American investors. American manufacturers like GM would stake their future on China. After a brief storm over the Taiwan Strait in 1995 to 1996, diplomatic relations calmed, but China's sheer size made it a contender. With the Tiananmen crackdown of 1989, the Communist Party had signaled its intent not to abandon its one-party leadership. Since then, it had fashioned a popular ideology that was as much nationalist as communist. If Washington was betting on international trade and globalization to westernize China, the Chinese Communist Party took the other side of the bet. The party's leaders wagered that supercharged growth would not weaken them, but would consolidate their position as the successful helmsman of their nation's spectacular comeback. Beijing took advantage of trading opportunities, but it never subscribed to fully open markets. It decided who would invest and on what terms. It controlled movement of funds in and out, That, in turn, allowed the People's Bank of China to fix its exchange rate, and since 1994 it had done so by pegging against the dollar. In choosing a dollar peg, China was far from unique. Despite the reigning narrative of market liberalization, the financial world was not flat. The global monetary system was hierarchical, with the key currency, the dollar, at the top of the pyramid. The 21st century began with a network of dollar-linked currencies accounting for around 65% of the world economy, weighted by GDP. Those currencies that were not pegged to the dollar tended to be hooked to the euro. Often pegging was a sign of weakness. In many cases, the exchange rate was set at an aspirational, overvalued rate. This created short-term advantages. It made imports cheap. Local oligarchs could snap up prestige foreign real estate at a discount. But it also harbored huge risk. The peg could break, and frequently it would do so with a bang. The appearance of stability offered by a fixed exchange rate encouraged a large inflow of foreign funds, which helped to stoke up domestic economic activity, creating an unbalanced trade account funded from abroad. Banks that acted as the conduit for foreign funds boomed. This set up the crisis. When international investors lost confidence, the result was a devastating sudden stop. Then the central bank's foreign exchange reserves would drain, and it would have no option but to let the currency peg go. Stability would give way to a disastrous devaluation. Those who got their money out first would be saved. Those who had borrowed in foreign currency would face bankruptcy. This was the saga of the 1990s. 1994 in Mexico, 1997 in Malaysia, South Korea, Indonesia, and Thailand, 1998 in Russia, 1999 in Brazil. It was containing these crises that earned U.S. Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan, Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin, and Larry Summers, Rubin's number two, the accolade of the Committee to Save the World. What happened when the American superheroes were not on hand was revealed in 2001. With the Bush administration fully distracted by the terror attack of 9/11, financial speculation built against Argentina. Despite a $22 billion loan from the IMF, without American backing, the Argentinian position became untenable. 80% of Argentine private debt was in dollars, whereas only 25% of Argentina's economy was export-oriented. In December 2001, with dollars draining out of the country, the Argentine government suspended access to bank accounts. Amid rioting that claimed the lives of 24 people, the government collapsed. On December 24, 2001, Argentina announced the suspension of payments on $144 billion of public debt, including $93 billion owed to foreign creditors. The peso plunged in value from 1-1 to 3-1 against the dollar, bankrupting the dollar debtors. The economy reeled backward to levels not seen since the early 1980s. As the 21st century began, more than half of Argentina's population fell below the poverty line. China had no intention of becoming either the victim of a sudden stop or the needy recipient of U.S. assistance. To reverse the balance of risk, when Beijing pegged its exchange rate, it chose one that was not too high, but too low. This was what Japan and Germany had done in the 1950s and 1960s. It was a recipe for export-led growth, but it created tensions of its own. Undervaluing the currency made imports more expensive than they needed to be, which lowered the Chinese standard of living. When it ran a trade surplus with the United States and bought American government bonds, poor China was exporting capital to rich America, funding American consumers to buy the products of its huge new factories. Moreover, maintaining the artificially low peg was a battle in its own right. With China's trade surplus with the United States surging from $83 billion in 2000 to $227 billion in 2009, to hold the value of the yuan down, the Chinese central bank had to continually buy dollars and sell its own currency. To do so, it printed yuan. In the normal course of things, this would have unleashed domestic inflation, wiping out any competitive advantage and triggering social unrest. So, To sterilize the effects of its own intervention, the People's Bank of China required all Chinese banks to hold large and growing precautionary reserves, effectively removing the currency from circulation. It was a profoundly unbalanced situation, and one that could be sustained only because of the extremely tight relationship between the Chinese regime and the business elite, a relationship built on common affiliation to the Communist Party, coercion, and mutual profit. Chinese businesses and their owners, the emerging oligarchs, profited spectacularly from a gigantic export-led development boom. Chinese peasants and workers chased the dream of urban prosperity. Meanwhile, Beijing's giant foreign currency reserves were the best guarantee an uncertain global economy could offer that in case of a crisis it would not be China's sovereignty that was violated. With so many currencies fixed against the dollar, without the possibility of adjusting export competitiveness by means of devaluation or appreciation, it was no surprise that the world economy polarized into export surplus and import deficit countries. In the first 3 months of 2005 alone, the United States ran a current account deficit, an excess of outward payments on trade in goods and services and investment income, of almost $200 billion. For the year, it came to $792 billion and was showing signs of further deterioration in 2006. For those on the surplus side of the global imbalances, so-called sovereign wealth funds, SWF, became huge repositories of capital. According to estimates by the Peterson Institute for International Economics in Washington, D.C., by 2007, emerging market sovereign wealth funds held at least $2 trillion in assets, in addition to the trillions in reserves held by their central banks. The Saudi Arabian Monetary Authority was flush with cash, as were the sovereign wealth funds of Norway and Singapore. Some sovereign wealth funds made adventurous investments in equities. China's State Administration of Foreign Exchange looked for safe and predictable returns. Its safe assets of choice were long-dated U.S. government debt and securities guaranteed by the U.S. government. The imbalances were worrying, but at least as far as the surplus countries were concerned, they promised that the first shock in the case of an unwinding would be borne by the other side. It was the United States, the world's great deficit economy, that would see its currency devalue and its interest rates surge as foreign investors abandoned American assets. It was this scenario that caused Orszag, Rubin and Senator Obama such concern. Nor were they alone. In the prestigious House Journal of the Council on Foreign Relations, Foreign Affairs, Peter G. Peterson, chairman of the Council, the Institute of International Economics, and the Blackstone Private Equity Group, raised the alarm about America's twin deficits. Economists Noriel Rubini and Brad Setzer warned that if investors were to lose confidence, the United States could face a very sudden depreciation of the dollar and a massive hike in interest rates. It might well turn out to be the worst recession experienced since World War II. And America would not only be depressed, it would be humbled at the hands of the rising power of Asia. Of course, if the United States suffered a crisis, China would be hurt too. Neil Ferguson and Moritz Scholarik came up with the term Chimerica to describe the Sino-American economic complex. For Larry Summers, who had moved from the Treasury to an ill-fated stint as president of Harvard, it reawakened memories of Cold War-era mutually assured destruction. At the heart of the world economy, he told Washington audiences, was a balance of financial terror. The difference was that in the Cold War, the economy had been America's strong suit. Now America's trump card consisted of the hope that it was simply too big for China to let it fail. It was hardly a reassuring diagnosis. To ease these imbalances, the obvious solution, as the Hamilton Project demanded, was fiscal restraint. Reduce the federal deficit, squeeze domestic demand, reduce the import of Chinese goods and Chinese money. But the Bush administration didn't seem to care. In 2004, former Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill, fired from the cabinet in 2002, released his revealing exposé of the early Bush administration. It contained a nugget that haunted the economic policy community. In November 2002, O'Neill tried to warn Vice President Dick Cheney that the surging budget deficits posed a threat to the economy, only for Cheney to cut him off with the following remark. You know, Reagan proved deficits don't matter. The Republicans had won the congressional midterms. Tax cuts were the Republican due. Within the month, O'Neill was fired. From the perspective of the Reubenite Democrats, this was not just economically illiterate, it was also a political scandal. Following in the footsteps of George Bush Sr., they had spent agonizing years working off Reagan's deficits. If Cheney's version of Republicanism prevailed, it undermined the basis for turn-taking in America's two-party system. How could the Democrats conduct responsible, national economic policy if the Republicans viewed the economy as a resource to be milked for the benefit of its privileged constituency? As Brad DeLong, Deputy Assistant Secretary for Economic Policy in the Clinton-era Treasury, ruefully remarked, "Rubin and us spear carriers moved heaven and earth to restore fiscal balance to the American government in order to raise the rate of economic growth. But what we turned out to have done was to enable George W. Bush's right-wing class war, his push for greater after-tax income inequality." The question was pressing because following the momentous November 2006 midterms, control of the House and the Senate changed hands. In a turn of events that can only be described as fateful, it would be the Democrats who held power in Congress during the greatest crisis of American capitalism since the 1930s. But that was in the future. In 2006, the question was whether the Democrats, as the new power on Capitol Hill, should once again take responsibility for cutting the deficit. Many in the party, especially those on the left, were wondering why they should accept the burden. As one centrist remarked, "On fiscal responsibility, it takes two to tango, and insofar as the GOP doesn't want to dance, Democrats can't afford to take sole responsibility." Perhaps the best way to prevent another wealth-polarizing offensive by a Republican Congress would be to spend so much on public works, welfare, and job creation that even a Republican would not consider adding tax cuts on top. As DeLong resignedly observed, the surplus-creating fiscal policies established by Robert Rubin and company in the Clinton administration would have been very good for America had the Clinton administration been followed by a normal successor. But what is the right fiscal policy for a future Democratic administration to follow when there is no guarantee that any Republican successors will ever be normal again? Given this dilemma, the disaster scenarios invoked by Orszag and Rubin take on a different meaning. They were as much about controlling the agenda within the Democratic Party as about winning over Republicans. If all that was at stake in the struggle over the deficit was a percentage point of economic growth here or there, why should the Democrats not put their own partisan priorities first? But if what threatened was a Weimar-style disaster, then surely the left wing of the Democrats would fall into line and prioritize budget cutting. Given the political impasse over fiscal policy and the evident imbalances of the U.S. economy, the other agents that one might have expected to swing into action were the mighty guardians at the Federal Reserve Board. Under the chairmanship of first Paul Volcker, 1979 to 1987, and then Alan Greenspan, 1987 to 2006, the authority of America's central bank soared to new heights. In terms of its expert authority and unassailable position within the structure of the U.S. government, it came to rival the U.S. security apparatus. The irony, however, was that as the Fed's reputation and authority grew, its key tool of policy seemed to be losing its effectiveness. The short-term interest rate set by the Fed no longer seemed to be setting the pace for the rest of the economy. Following the dot-com crash, Greenspan had cut rates to 3.5%. After the 9/11 attacks, there were further cuts, reaching 1% in the summer of 2003. Then, from 2004 on, the Fed started raising rates. Faced with America's trade deficit and its rapid domestic boom, this was the standard prescription. It should increase private saving and restrict investment. But to the Fed's dismay, the results were feeble. Most strikingly, as the Fed hiked short-term rates, rates in long-term bond markets failed to respond. There were too many buyers of long-term bonds, driving prices up and yields down. nor should this have been a surprise. By fixing their currencies against the dollar, many of America's trading partners prevented not only a downward movement of the dollar which might have restored America's competitiveness, they also prevented an appreciation of the American currency which would normally have followed on an interest rate increase. Under de facto fixed exchange rates, an increase in the interest rates would not reduce the supply of credit. It had the opposite effect of making investment in the United States more attractive, drawing in a greater flow of foreign funds. The Fed found itself boxed in between China's determination to peg its currency and the refusal of Congress to curb America's budget deficit. China's unbalanced growth path created an excess of savings that needed to be invested abroad. AAA-rated U.S. treasuries were the reserve asset of choice. As a newly appointed member of the Federal Reserve Board, one of the first contributions to the policy debate by the Princeton economist Ben Bernanke was to coin the term global savings glut, to describe this situation in which the Fed's principal policy instrument lost its leverage on the economy. The availability of foreign funding negated Fed efforts to raise interest rates. At the same time, it reduced the pressure on Congress to tighten fiscal policy. As capital surged in, this pushed down U.S. interest rates, stoking the domestic economic upswing and sucking in imports, above all from China. But barring a change of heart on the part of Congress, or a general liberalization of exchange rates, there was little the Fed could do. This was the ambiguous inheritance that Bernanke stepped into on February 1, 2006, as he took up the baton of Fed chair. Bernanke's placid and undersized persona would soon come to occupy an outsized space in global economic history. He would turn out to be an unusual but highly significant case of the possibility of learning lessons from history. In November 2002, at a birthday celebration for Milton Friedman and Anna Schwartz, Friedman's co-author in the monumental Monetary History of the United States, The Bible of Monetarism, Bernanke promised, "I would like to say to Milton and Anna, regarding the Great Depression, you're right, we did it, we're very sorry, but thanks to you, we won't do it again." Given the association forged in the 1970s between monetarism and inflation fighting, one could easily confuse Bernanke's promise with a conventional central banker's commitment to price stability. Indeed, Bernanke was making a commitment to price stability, but what he was promising to prevent was deflation, not inflation. The lesson of the 1930s was that the Fed must act promptly not just to prevent the money supply expanding excessively, but also to prevent bank failures from causing it to implode. On Bernanke's watch, there would be no deflation. That single-minded determination, embodied by the new Fed chair but shared across the U.S. policymaking establishment, would define the response of monetary policy to the crisis. In the process, Bernanke would redefine what a central bank can do as an agency of modern government. Given the weight of this hindsight, it is easy to forget how unremarkable his appointment seemed at the time. He was a safe pair of hands, no outsized ego, a reliable middle-of-the-road Republican. In policy terms, he was known, above all, for his belief that the best way to perpetuate the era of the Great Moderation, in which both unemployment and inflation were fluctuating much less than ever before, was a rules-based approach to policymaking he described as constrained discretion. As an economist steeped in the disastrous history of the 1920s and 1930s gold exchange standard, Bernanke knew all too well the perils of a lopsided fixed exchange rate system. He was profoundly critical of China's currency policy. But relations among central bankers are polite. It was not for the Fed to lecture the Chinese on currency policy. The same rules did not apply to the U.S. Treasury or to Congress. In the early 2000s, dozens of bills began to move through Congress, accusing China of being a currency manipulator in violation of WTO norms and demanding sanctions. It was those initiatives that raised fears in circles like the Hamilton Project about populist protectionism. In July 2005, to relieve pressure on the U.S. economy, China began to allow a slow currency appreciation. In due course, this would bring about a 23% revaluation. but it was painfully slow. To speed things up, some in Washington favored activating the IMF. Why was the global monetary watchdog not calling on China to address its lopsided balance of payments? In September 2005, Treasury Undersecretary Tim Adams remarked in a widely reported speech that the IMF appeared to be asleep at the wheel. But to promote the IMF as an arbiter had serious implications. China could not be expected to take advice from the IMF until it had representation on the IMF's board that was commensurate with its size. Furthermore, Beijing would expect IMF monitoring to apply to the United States as well. That wasn't likely to appeal to a Republican White House. Barring market-driven adjustment or international supervision, the balance of financial terror was managed by means of summit diplomacy in the manner of the Cold War. And it was no coincidence that as his last Treasury Secretary, President Bush chose Hank Paulson. Paulson, like Rubin, moved to the Treasury from the CEO job at Goldman Sachs. But apart from his investment banking credentials, what recommended Paulson for the job was his reputation as an old China hand. He liked to boast that since the Tiananmen Square massacre, he had visited China 70 times. He had no particular fondness for multilateral institutions like the IMF. Instead, he preferred bilateral dialogue, what some had taken to calling the G2 format. One of Paulson's first moves was to initiate a U.S.-China strategic economic dialogue and to take personal charge of the U.S. side. In the fall of 2007, even as quite a different crisis loomed on the horizon, it was the dollar that was still at the center of attention. The Economist warned of a dollar panic. Germany's Spiegel magazine announced a Pearl Harbor without a war. Bill Gross, the kingpin at bond trading giant PIMCO, was reported to be selling dollar assets, as was billionaire investor Warren Buffett. In November 2007, Bloomberg reported that the world's highest-paid supermodel, the Brazilian Gisela Bündchen, had demanded that Procter & Gamble pay her in euros for endorsing their Pantene brand. With a net worth of more than $300 million, Bündchen could not afford to ignore sentiment in the currency markets. Meanwhile, hip-hop star Jay-Z took to thumbing wads of euros on MTV. If the euro was the new bling, was the dollar really about to go out of style? In the summer of 2007, the year before he was awarded the Nobel Prize, Paul Krugman sketched the logic of what he described as a Wile E. Coyote moment, in which foreign investors would suddenly realize that there was nothing holding the dollar up other than their own purchasing of it. Like the cartoon character suspended in midair by the propeller motion of his own legs, the dollar was hanging above a precipice. It was comforting, Krugman reassured his readers, that most of America's debts were in its own currency, so the impact of the dollar collapse would be cushioned. It wouldn't be Argentina. But if the Fed was forced suddenly to hike interest rates, the United States would face a severe contraction. This, Krugman concluded, won't be fun. The best and brightest in American economic policy were not wrong to worry about the Sino-American imbalance. If it had blown up, it would have been a disaster. 10 years on, the scenario still hangs over the world economy. The threat of crisis was contained in 2008 because there were deep interests engaged on both sides and because it was handled as a matter of top priority by both Washington and Beijing. From the outset, Sino-American financial relations were explicitly politicized and were understood as a matter of great power diplomacy. No one was under any illusion that it was simply a market relationship, a matter of business as usual. When Paulson was worried about a Chinese dollar sell-off, he knew whom in Beijing to call. Larry Summers's Cold War analogy proved more apt than he realized. The balance of financial terror held. But in the meantime, what became increasingly clear was that the U.S. policymaking elite had been focused, as Bradford DeLong would put it, on the wrong crisis. The crisis that will forever be associated with 2008 was not an American sovereign debt crisis driven by a Chinese sell-off, but a crisis fully native to Western capitalism. A meltdown on Wall Street, driven by toxic, securitized subprime mortgages that threatened to take Europe down with it. Chapter 2 Subprime. When the economists linked to the Hamilton Project envisioned disaster, they worried about excessive public debt, underperforming schools, and a Chinese sell-off. What they did not put in question was the basic functioning of America's economy, its banks and financial markets. America's problems were its people, its society, its politics, not its economy as such. And yet by 2006, if one looked in the right place, it was evident that something was seriously amiss. Since the early 2000s, the American economy had been buoyed not only by huge fiscal deficits, but by a sustained surge in house prices. Now, in some of the most challenged neighborhoods in the country, tens of thousands of families who had recently taken out home loans were failing to make payments. In marginal ethnic minority communities in cities like Cincinnati and Cleveland, but also in ribbon developments in the Sunshine States, mortgages were failing en masse. America's housing market bull run was about to come to a juddering halt, and as it did so, it would precipitate a global crisis. For tens of millions of Americans, this crisis hit them where it hurt most, at home. But compared with the grand sweep of global economic imbalances and the Sino-American relationship, the mechanics of American mortgage finance cannot but appear a parochial concern. How could this domestic drama shake the world's financial system and precipitate a global crisis? The simple answer is that real estate may be mundane and mansions may be nondescript, but they account for a huge share of total marketable wealth worldwide. By one estimate, the share of American real estate in global wealth is as much as 20%. American homes account for 9% of the total. At the time of the crisis, 70% of American households owned their own home, more than 80 million in total. Those same households were the greatest source of demand for the world economy. In 2007, American consumers bought around 16% of global output, and nothing made them feel better than surging real estate prices. As America's home prices almost doubled in the 10 years leading to 2006, this raised household wealth by $6.5 trillion, delivering a giant boost not just to the United States, but to the world economy. As U.S. consumer spending surged toward $10 trillion, it added $937 billion to global demand between 2000 and 2007. Fluctuations on such huge scales can clearly help account for a business cycle downturn in 2007, but to explain how this could trigger a financial crisis, with bank failures spreading panic and a credit crunch across the world, there is one crucial thing to add. Real estate is not only the largest single form of wealth, it is also the most important form of collateral for borrowing. It is mortgage debt that both amplifies the broader economic cycle and links the house price cycle to the financial crisis. Between the 1990s and the outbreak of the crisis in 2007, American housing finance was turned into a dynamic and destabilizing force by a fourfold transformation. The securitization of mortgages, their incorporation into expansive and high-risk strategies of banking growth, the mobilization of new funding sources, and internationalization. All four of these changes can be traced back to the transformation in world economic affairs between the late 1970s and the early 1980s, in the wake of the collapse of Bretton Woods. On October 6, 1979, after an unscheduled meeting of the Federal Reserve's key interest rate-setting committee, the Federal Open Market Committee, FOMC, Paul Volcker, the Fed chair, announced that the Fed would henceforth attempt to tightly regulate bank reserves and that interest rates could be expected to rise. It was the Fed's response to a wave of inflation that was threatening domestic instability, America's global standing, and the status of the dollar. Since Nixon had unhooked the dollar from gold, the world's currencies had floated against one another without a metallic anchor. Only political discipline prevented limitless printing of currency. Contrary to some fears, there was no runaway inflation. But with prices accelerating toward annual increases of 14% in 1979, Volcker and the Fed decided that it was time to apply the brakes. It was the moment the power of the modern Fed was born. The interest rate was its weapon. As Germany's outspoken Chancellor Helmut Schmidt put it, Volcker pushed real interest rates adjusted for inflation, to levels not seen since the birth of Christ. He did not exaggerate. In June 1981, the prime lending rate touched 21%. The result was to send a shuddering shock through both the American and the global economies. The dollar surged, as did unemployment. Inflation collapsed from 14.8% in March 1980 to 3% by 1983. In Britain, this was the crisis with which the Thatcher government began. In Germany, it would contribute to Schmidt's unseating and his replacement by the conservative government of Helmut Kohl. France's socialist government under President François Mitterrand would be forced into line in 1983. Volcker's shock set the stage for what Ben Bernanke would later dub the Great Moderation. It was an end not just to inflation, but to a large part of the manufacturing base in the Western economies, and with it the bargaining power of the trade unions. No longer would they be able to drive up wages in line with prices. And there was another part of America's post-war political economy that did not survive the disinflationary shock of the 1980s, the peculiar system of housing finance that had emerged from the New Deal era. Since the 1930s, America's housing finance had been based on commercial banks and local savings banks, so-called savings and loans, making long-term fixed interest loans. By the late 1960s, 30-year fixed interest loans had become normal, with as little as 5% in down payment. The funding was provided by depository institutions, which offered government-insured savings accounts with capped interest rates. This was the basis on which home ownership had expanded to almost 66% of households by the 1970s. For homeowners on fixed-interest long-term mortgages, the inflation of the post-Bretton Woods era was a windfall. The real value of their loans was eaten up while their interest rates remained fixed. For the banks that lent to them, it was a disaster. In an era of inflation and fluctuating interest rates, and the capped interest rates inherited from the 1950s, they could not retain their depositors, let alone attract new ones. To borrow from money markets or issue bonds, they now faced the withering interest rates set by the Fed. Meanwhile, their portfolios of fixed-interest mortgages were devalued as rates on new loans soared. By the early 1980s, the vast majority of the almost 4,000 savings and loan banks still in operation were insolvent. Given the cost of cleaning them up and the prevailing free market ideology of the Reagan era, the path of least resistance was to deregulate and lower capital standards in the hope that they could grow themselves out of trouble. The commercial banks survived this trial by fire. The savings and loans did not. More than 1,000 failed. Most of the rest were bailed out, bought up, or amalgamated. The resolution costs to the taxpayer were around $124 billion in 1990s dollars. By the late 1980s, the macroeconomic picture was stabilizing. Inflation was down, and interest rates were falling. Whereas most bond investors did well in the new era, anyone who held mortgage loans had to reckon with another risk. American mortgage borrowers have the right to repay early and refinance at lower rates. This boosts the economy, as borrowers can reduce their mortgage payments, and as borrowers, they tend to have a higher propensity to consume than those they borrow from. But for the lender, it means that the U.S. mortgage contract is highly one-sided. During a period of rising rates, their fixed-rate loans will devalue. During a loosening of monetary policy, when rates fall, the borrowers refinance. Lending for 30-year terms at fixed rates is a viable business proposition only under the kinds of conditions of stability that prevailed under Bretton Woods between 1945 and 1971. In a new age of flexible monetary arrangements, it was dangerously one-sided, especially if the risks were concentrated in small mortgage lenders with limited means of funding themselves. The solution was to go for scale, to adopt a new market-based model of financing, and to place government institutions at the centre of the system. The basic anchor of America's mortgage system in the aftermath of the savings and loans debacle was the so-called government-sponsored enterprise, GSE. The mothership of the GSEs was Fannie Mae, founded in 1938 to create a secondary market for lenders who were willing to issue the new type of government-insured Federal Housing Authority mortgages promoted by the New Deal. Fannie Mae did not issue mortgages. It bought them mainly from commercial banks across the United States that specialized in issuing FHA-insured mortgages. By acting as a backstop, Fannie Mae lowered the cost of lending and set a national standard for both lenders and prime borrowers. It helped to unify America through mortgage debt. Fannie Mae was able to fund its purchases of these standardized mortgages cheaply because its credit rating was that of a government agency that could not fail. So-called agency debt was equivalent to that of the Treasury. By the same token, the obligations of Fannie Mae featured on the federal government's balance sheet. To get them off at a time of fiscal stress during the Vietnam War in 1968, Fannie Mae was privatized. The branch still devoted to making loans to public employees and veterans was split off as Ginny Mae. New Fannie Mae was licensed to buy any mortgages, government guaranteed or not, that conformed to certain quality standards, so-called conforming loans. And in 1970, Congress legislated into existence a third agency, the Federal Home Loan Mortgage Corporation, or Freddie Mac, to level the playing field by buying up mortgage loans issued by savings and loans. Despite this government guarantee, with their large portfolios of fixed interest loans, the GSEs were hit hard by the Volcker shock of the early 1980s. Fannie Mae came close to failure. But it survived, and as the housing market recovered in the 1990s, the GSEs flourished. Thanks to their residual tie to the federal government, the GSEs continued to enjoy a substantial discount in funding costs. By the end of the century, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac together were backstopping at least 50% of the total national mortgage market. Creating conforming loans, loans that qualified for GSE backstop, was the basis of the American home loan business. It is a deep irony that the era in which America is commonly thought of as leading the world in a market revolution saw its housing market become dependent on a government-sponsored mortgage machine descended from the New Deal. It was also the source of deep and irreducible politicization of the mortgage issue in the United States. American housing policy and mortgage practice since the war had systematically favored home ownership for the white majority. In the 1990s, promoting home ownership for lower income and underserved minority communities became a congressional priority. The Federal Housing Enterprises Financial Safety and Soundness Act of 1992 called for lending goals to be set for the GSEs. In December 1995, the government issued targets for underserved areas and low-income housing. Many of the new homeowners in the 1990s and 2000s were ethnic minority families who had been denied mortgages for decades under the regime of redlining institutionalized by New Deal housing policy. Viewed in this way, the real estate boom was part of the rise of the diverse African-American and Latino middle class, on which the Democrats as a political party had a lot riding. On the back of their influence over the Democratic Party, the GSEs built one of the most powerful lobbies in Washington, D.C. Their political firepower was legendary. By the same token, the GSE mortgage regime also attracted the ire of the American right. Deep down, most free market advocates are convinced that the interferences of the GSEs were responsible for the disaster that was beginning to unfold in 2006. The GSEs had political mandates set by progressives to funnel money into underserved communities. They had a market-distorting funding advantage due to their attachment to the federal government. When you distort the market, crises are inevitable. It was this conservative critique of the GSEs that shaped the Republican reaction when the crisis reached fever pitch in 2008. For many in Congress, the bailout was not just of the banks. They at least were private businesses trying to make a buck. The bailout was also a desperate effort to make the taxpayer pay for the rescue of a Democrat-controlled parastate housing welfare apparatus designed to serve pampered minorities. This was powerful mobilizing rhetoric for the Republican base, but as an explanation of the crisis that was brewing in 2006, this political critique is wide of the mark. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac set a high minimum standard for the quality of loans they would buy. The GSEs didn't support the kind of low-quality subprime loans that were beginning to fail in droves in 2005-2006. Those toxic loans were the products of a new system of mortgage finance driven by private lenders that came into full force in the early 2000s. Though the GSEs met their government lending quotas, private lenders driven by the search for profit were far more adventurous in lending to underserved communities. In this sense, the GSEs did not create the crisis. But what they did contribute were two innovations without which the crisis is hard to imagine: the originate-to-distribute mortgage lending system and securitization. From its origins in the 1930s, the GSE model of subsidy separated the origination of a mortgage from its ultimate funding. The commercial banks that issued the original loans to American families were repaid when they sold the mortgages to Fannie Mae. That enabled them to make more loans. It was the debt issued by the GSEs to finance the mortgages they were holding on their balance sheets that ultimately funded the loan. This was the basic structure of what became known as originate-to-distribute. Mortgage lenders no longer needed to hold the mortgages on their balance sheets. They became brokers operating for a fee. The government-backed credit rating of the GSEs backstopped the entire system. Starting in the 1970s, as they confronted the instability of interest rates and its damaging implications for America's mortgage model, the GSEs took a further critical step. Working with the help of investment banks, they pioneered securitization. Rather than holding the locally originated mortgages on their own books and financing them by issuing bonds, they would sell the mortgages directly to investors. To do so, they packaged the mortgages into pools in which they sold shares, securities. The idiosyncratic risks of individual loans would be pooled. Investors looking to hold real estate could buy a portfolio of broadly based exposure without having to build a branch network necessary to make loans across the far-flung economy of the United States. They did so fully aware of the risks and returns generated by the fluctuation of interest rates. Rather than having small savings and loans gamble on what was a viable loan, securitization would let the collective process of market haggling determine funding costs. In 1970, Ginnie Mae carried out the first securitization. It was a simple model, a so-called pass-through, under which the flows of revenue from a pool of mortgages were passed by way of the GSE to investors. Not satisfied that this should remain a public monopoly, Louis Ranieri and his team at hard-driving investment bank Salomon Brothers put together the first private securitization of mortgages for Bank of America in 1977. But it took a brave investor to buy a package of fixed-interest mortgages at that moment. It was in the aftermath of the interest rate shock of the early 1980s that really pushed securitization to the fore. The mortgage lender, stranded with portfolios of low-interest mortgages, turned to the market to recover whatever value they would yield by securitizing them and selling them off. From the 1980s, the GSEs, working with the investment banks, created not just pass-through mortgage-backed securities, MBS, but so-called collateralized mortgage obligations, CMO, that allowed a pool of MBS to be tranched into separate risk tiers profiles. This was the origin of so-called structured finance. Those with a top-tier first claim on the revenue stream had low risk of both default and early repayment. Tranches lower down the pecking order could be sold off to investors looking for riskier investments. The top-tier senior tranches would pay out, except in the highly unlikely event of massive collective default. Those top tranches, even if they were based on a pool of high-yielding, high-risk debt, could be designated as low-risk, and the ratings agencies obliged by classifying them as AAA. 80% of most securitizations were designated as senior and given the AAA rating. Not surprisingly, given the very high ratings they handed out for MBS, the role of the ratings agencies would later become highly controversial. By the 1990s, Moody's Investors Service and Standard & Poor's divided 80% of the global debt rating business between them. Fitch took another 15% of the market. They did not attain that control of the global market by freely handing out top AAA ratings. In 2008, there are only 6 AAA-rated corporations and no more than a dozen countries enjoying that ranking. This was despite the fact that since the 1980s, it was issuers of debt who paid the ratings agencies to make their classifications, not the subscribers to their information services. Payment by the issuer created a conflict of interest. But the agencies had much to lose if they appeared to be selling good ratings, and relatively little to gain if they showed favour to a client that was involved in only occasional bond issues. The mortgage securitization business changed that calculus. The sheer volume of mortgage-backed security issuance involving tens of thousands of tranches, combined with the fact that the flow was concentrated in the hands of a few issuers, gave the ratings agencies a significant incentive to be helpful. But even more important was the nature of MBS as such. What made rating MBS different was that the underlying assets were not bonds issued by a company facing the unpredictable force of global competition. The MBS bundled thousands of what were supposed to be predictable assets, regular domestic mortgages. The ratings agencies did not have to calculate the risks of default on the basis of more or less subjective evaluations of a company's business prospects, nor did they have to render a judgment on a country's fiscal policy. Instead, they could apply standardized financial mathematics to a population of mortgages that was assumed to have well-known statistical properties. If you knew default rates and could make assumptions about the degree of correlation between them, once you assemble enough mortgages and tranched them, the likelihood of the top tranches not paying was infinitesimal. Tens of thousands of asset-backed securities thus qualified for ultra-safe AAA ratings. What happened to the tranches lower down the pile was another matter altogether. There the risk of failure was much higher than if one simply held the mortgage pool. But at the right yield, they too would find a buyer. The idea, in the wake of the savings and loans disaster, was to spread risk outward from those immediately involved in lending to mortgage borrowers, and to attract investors by turning mortgages into securities that offered a wide range of yield risk profiles. And it worked. In 1980, 67% of American mortgages had been held directly on the balance sheets of depository banks. By the end of the 1990s, the risks involved in America's system of long-term fixed interest, easy repayment mortgages were securitized and spread across a much wider segment of the financial system than had been the case in 1979 when Volcker made his shock announcement. The GSEs held them, banks held them, but so too did pension and insurance funds. Compared with the model of the savings and loan, securitization thus did its job in spreading risk. But did it, by the same token, reduce the incentive to carefully monitor the underlying loans? By splitting origination from funding, had the new system eliminated the incentive to monitor loans carefully? Whereas a local lender that held a mortgage for its entire 30-year duration had every reason